announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show for Wednesday, July 1st. We're joined by a leader of men, the Marine, former UFC superstar, and current Fox Sports analyst, Brian Stan. What's going on, Brian?
Nothing much, man. Hanging out at home. I actually have a weekend at home this weekend, so I will savor that and enjoy some time with the family.
And as always, I'm joined by Filthy Tom Lawler.
Oh, yes, you are.
And, you know, Brian, Tom is making his return to the UFC, first time in 2 years. July 24th, is it, Tom?
25th.
25th.
In Chicago.
Yes.
I saw that, and I also saw how excited you are about your new Reebok uniform.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's interesting that you bring that up, Brian, because I did see a quote from you saying that, you know, you've talked to quite a few guys, and they're very happy with it. So
that's not what I said. You misquoted me, Tom.
Okay. Can you tell me exactly what you said,
though? There we go. So that what they took that quote from a longer statement. But anyways, what I had said was I was surprised. I thought more guys were going to be unhappy about it. 60% of the more than half of the guys that I've spoken to actually like it. And that really surprised me. I did not expect that. Now, a lot of those guys that I have spoken to are your undercard fighters. They're Brazilian fighters. You know, the biggest surprise to me was Ryan LaFleur. When I spoke to Ryan LaFleur, and Ryan just said to me, he said, look, my last three fights, I was supposed to get over $10,000 in sponsors. And he goes, I never get the money. He goes, I haven't even gotten five. He goes, my last fight, I was supposed to get $12,000 when I main evented against Damian Maia. He goes, I've gotten $3,000.
Wow.
Yeah, I read that article. Yeah, I mean, that's discouraging that these guys aren't paying up. But I guess that seems to be the norm in this business. They promise, and then, you know, even the legitimate companies seem to be late with payment.
That's frustrating to me. You know, part of it, I'm always pro fighter, and I'm always going to come back to the fighter though and hold us accountable. And so I did very well in sponsors when I fought. Now, that's also, people have told me right after I retired, the market really started to dip off. And that actually came from Daniel Cormier. Cormier told me, he goes, Stan, it's not the same as it was, man. You know, my sponsors have taken a huge hit. But during that time, I mean, I hustled for my sponsors. The first month when I was done fighting, I mean, I would have tons of appearances, speeches, commercial shoots, holiday video shoots, whatever I needed to do to be a brand ambassador, not just someone who tweets once a month about them and then wears their logo. Nobody sees their damn logo in the Octagon anyways. No one was going to Veterans United Mortgage Company because they saw it on my leg when I threw a kick at some point. But they may have gone there when I did a feature in their magazine, when I filmed their holiday commercial, when I did a commercial for them, when I did quarterly radio tours for them to talk about my experience using them for my VA loan vice, the myriad of other companies I could have used. And so, you know, I really push it on these fighters to first step, find a decent manager. And if you can't find a decent one, then go without one until you can. And there's not many to choose from. You know, we all know that. And then when you do, please remember the manager works for you. I've heard so many managers talk to their fighters, and the manager legitimately talks these guys like they work for him. And that makes me sick. And then when it comes time, you know, Tom, you could attest to this. I mean, we do a bad job at getting back to people. I mean, to get a fighter to answer his email or answer text message could sometimes require a very long period of time. And if you want companies to truly depend on you, they don't want to talk to you through your manager all the time. They want to sponsor you because they want a relationship with you. They want to be able to tell the guys at work and the people from, you know, other suppliers in the industry, yeah, we got this great relationship with Tom Lawler. He came to our holiday party. You know, then he came to this other company event. He's just been awesome. He gave us this big speech about this fight that he came back and won, how tough it was. That's the kind of stuff employers and sponsors may want, and I just push fighters to get creative and don't give up on it just because of the Reebok deal.
Do you think it's any coincidence, Brian, that the amount of sponsorship dropped off after you retired, or do you think it's a direct correlation to your stepping away from the game?
You know, it definitely has to be. You know what I mean? There were companies that wanted to pay to be in the Octagon just because I would every once in a while go in there and maybe win or lose a fight. But the problem was they weren't giving me money, Tom, so I don't know. good question, though. You know, I think the sponsor tax, you know, it took a lot of companies out. We all know that. But the other part is I just don't think a lot of companies were getting a return on their investment. I mean, how many have we seen come and go that went in, threw a bunch of money around, and then went out of business?
Yeah, it was like everybody who knew a screen printer thought that they were going to become this apparel giant. They were going to become Under Armour or Nike. But, you know, I mean, this is a little tie-in with something that you do, Brian. I was talking to Ryan Bader, and he wasn't thrilled about the Reebok deal. He has a whole bunch of sponsors outside the Octagon, you know, that pay him, you know, like you were getting those monthly payments. And he would take a portion of that sponsorship money and divert them to various charities, including the one that you head up, Hire Heroes. And he said, he didn't say he's going to stop doing that, but he said it's a little bit more difficult when the sponsor money, you know, there's not much there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I got to give him a lot of credit. I mean, we're not talking chump change here. You're talking about a man that has now twice given Hire Heroes USA $5,000. That's very rare for an individual to give that amount of money, especially if that individual isn't a multimillionaire. You know, we've received donations like that, and it's people on Wall Street that are probably staring at no less than $20 million, you know, as their net worth. Here's Ryan Bader, who I can't imagine is anywhere near that, even though he makes good money, and he's doing that. I mean, that's a very charitable guy. And I will tell you that the fight where he wore our logo on his T-shirt on Fox when he fought Phil Davis, we did see an impact from that. You know, so we were pretty fortunate. You know, the night that he chose, and we couldn't be more grateful. But yeah, it's gonna drive some of those things away. I do think he got American Ethanol back on board, which was one of his biggest ones. And he's a guy who hustles for his sponsors. He does a lot of. He's got a great manager, and he does a lot of creative things, you know, to keep some of those companies on board.
Tom, what are you doing?
That's not me.
So, oh, no.
Well, I'm just listening. I'm sitting back and I'm listening to the man of men. Speak.
No. The leader of men.
Leader of men. I apologize.
A leader of men. That I stole that from Chael. Chael used to call you that.
Yeah, when he got all nice guy before we fought. That's what he does. He makes you really like him, so you don't want to hit him.
But you know, he actually really does like you.
Oh, we got along. We had when we fought right before we weighed in. Bert had to come and yell at us because we were still sitting back on these. We didn't stand in line. And we were talking about whether or not Herman Cain was going to last as a presidential candidate. And we were deep in conversation. Then we forgot. We had to go weigh in. So then we go weigh in. And there were some fans after the weigh-ins were over that wanted our autograph or whatnot. All the vans had left. And so me and Chael had to ride back to the hotel all by ourselves. And he kept trying to give me these cookies. So here's a guy who's eaten after getting off the scale. I mean, drinks a Coke and eats Oreo cookies. So if it doesn't get any worse that he beats you, that's what he had to prepare for you. And we're walking to the hotel lobby, and all the fans are there waiting, and they were so disappointed. Like, wait a minute. Come on, guys. You guys are at least act like you're going to hit each other tomorrow.
And you would think of all the people he would get that. You know, because he's always the one, you know, even if he loses to somebody, he doesn't break character. He's not going to say, oh, I like Anderson or, you know.
No, he's phenomenal at it. And I mean, how quick-witted he can be, it's unlike anybody else in television. I've done a few things now. I've been around a little bit. I've never met someone who can be so quick on their feet and always be entertaining. It's one thing, you know, to be a good analyst or to say smart things, but to always be entertaining is really, really difficult.
Brian, you were talking a second ago about weigh-in, so I'd like to stay on that topic a little bit just because there's been some recent developments with how the weigh-ins are going to go down. And basically what I'm getting at is the taking away of IVs. Now, I guess they've changed the rule a little bit, and you're going to be allowed some sort of IV up until October 1st. It's kind of a grace period for fighters who have been using IVs in the past. But you've been linked for years to George Lockhart, who is, you know, from what I hear, is one of the absolute best nutrition guys going in the game today. So can you give your thoughts, I guess, a little bit on the taking away of IVs for some fighters and I guess your overall thoughts on the IV situation as it is?
Yeah, you know, I will soon find out why. I think I'm scheduled to visit USADA headquarters in August. And so I will try to get, you know, and I'm sure they're going to tell everybody, you know, they're not going to try to hide anything. So I don't know if it's to stop people from trying to dope, if that's a way of hiding it. Obviously, they're trying to be safe. I will tell you this. George Lockhart hated the fact that I would get an IV. Hated it. I would take two bags every fight, and he couldn't stand it because he thought that, hey, look, I know it feels good and it's all comfortable, but you're actually not getting the nutrients absorbed into the muscles like you would be if you would follow my program and do it the old-fashioned way. And so he would always, not only would he fight me on the IV, he would argue with me and say, just take one bag, please. Don't take two. And so sometimes, okay, fine, I won't take the second bag. But when I fought George Santiago, I had all the stuff for an IV sent out, and but I was going to try and get Tate, this gentleman named Tate, who used to do all these IVs before he became a cut man. Yeah. And problem was, Tate was a black zillion at the time. And so Tate told me he was going to come give me an IV, and then he never showed up. Pretty slick, because he was probably busy giving George Santiago his IV. And so I had to use this equipment that I had my Marine buddy send me out to, and I had, you know, a Marine buddy trying to inject. And anyways, long story short, he blows both of my veins on both sides. And it's, all right, guys, this enough's enough. Give me a jug of water. I'm going to do this the old-fashioned way. And I got to tell you, it was about the same time at night that I was peeing clear that I would be had I done the IVs. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, if you make it a big deal in your mind, then it's going to be a big deal. You know, that saying, as you think you are. And I just didn't let it affect me. I'm not going to allow this guy to beat me because I didn't get an IV. I'm going to run through this guy. And it ended up not being a problem for me. Now, because so many other people did it and I was comfortable doing IVs, I did go back to it. So it'll be really interesting to see how this develops. But for me, I would show up the week of the fight at 206 and cut down to 185 and then go back up. So I wasn't a small middleweight by any means. And if I was able to do it, I assume other people will. So I think the need for guys like George Lockhart is going to go up a little bit. You know, and it'll be interesting to see how does USADA plan to really check for that. I mean, are they going to call fighters right after weigh-ins and go check their hotel rooms?
I don't know. No. And I mean, they put the policy out saying no IVs, and then they've already changed their stance on that and given kind of a grace period there. So, you know, it seems like a lot of these things, and even with the Reebok deal, this stuff's kind of in flux, and it fluctuates with exactly what the protocol is and what's happening. And just for, you know, for your future, you know, if you ever fight again or you know anybody that'll be at the MGM, you could have paid $100 and they have people that'll do IVs on site for you.
So, really? At MGM?
Yes.
Well, of course, it's Vegas. Why wouldn't they? Yeah, to keep people in the game and spending money. Unbelievable.
Exactly.
Only a guy who's boring like me wouldn't know that.
Well, how are you going to go to Wet Republic if you're too hungover to get out of bed?
I've never gone to it. Yeah, see, this is what happens when you get married before you start your mixed martial arts career. You don't get to go to Wet Republic. I've never even been to rehab. All those years I fought in the WEC, rehab was always going on. I was like, man, that'd be really cool if I was single, but man, I never went.
Yeah, man, that brings back some memories. I saw your fight March 2008 at the Hard Rock. Who'd you fight, Marshall?
That was when I fought Doug Marshall, and go figure. The co-main event that night was Chael Sonnen taking on Brian Baker.
That's right. And Brian Baker got leukemia or either after that fight or – I mean, he had a health scare there.
Oh, what a nice – he's a super nice guy too. Really, really nice guy. Chael and I were in the same locker room for that one because Matt Lindland snuck into my corner. He wasn't supposed to be there. He just stayed down after Chael's fight. And then all of a sudden, I turn around. I got in the small or whatever the hell it is. Oh, there's Linlin.
Linlin, what a character that guy
his,
is.
His advice was, hey, get your hands up in front of your face as fast as you put them out there.
Yeah, Matt is Matt's a character. He's coaching the national Greco team now.
Yeah.
It seems like he's fishing more than he's coaching, but, you know, that's Linlin for you. But a lot of people, I mean, you went out and you trained at Team Quest, like, before like, anybody knew who you were. Isn't that, you went out to Portland?
I did. So I, when did I go to Portland first? So the first thing I did when I landed, I was back from Iraq, my second tour, a day. Scott Adams from the WC calls me and says, hey, I want to bring you out here for a photo shoot because I had a fight 7 weeks from the day that I landed against Steve Cantwell. And he's like, hey, I want to bring you out to Vegas for a photo shoot. You could bring your wife. You guys will have a good time. I figured, okay, why not? You know, I had 6 weeks to train for the, you know, I knew nothing back then. And I didn't know any better to think that like I needed to train for a long time for a 3-5 minute round fight. So I fly out there and Scott Adams completely bullshitted me. We get there. He's jogging to the car. My wife's in heels. Like, we're there. Hey, I haven't seen this woman in 7 months. Kind of want to get to know her again. We've never lived together. And here we are at the Mandalay Bay. And he's immediately taking me to Randy Couture's gym, immediately taking me to J-Sect. I'm going to Cobra Kai. I'm there sparring Roy Nelson with no mouthpiece and borrowed shin guards and gloves. And this guy, Skipper, the coach of J-Sect, I don't think that gym even exists anymore, goes, hey, we're going to be doing five-minute rounds, guys. I had never done a five-minute round to that point. Whenever I trained, I'd do like 2 or 3-minute rounds. I didn't think people really did those five-minute rounds. So Roy Nelson hit me so hard that Iraqi sand came flying out of my ears, almost launched me over the ropes. It was a very humbling weekend trip to Vegas, and it was awful. Awful. Mike Pyle hit on my wife so bad at Extreme Couture. It was almost comical to watch. I would have paid more attention or maybe gotten upset if I wasn't getting my butt kicked so bad on the mats.
She came to the gym?
Yeah. Well, she had nothing else to do. We went out there thinking we were going to see sights and go do some fun stuff. So I made the rookie mistake of bringing my wife to a fighter gym. And it was funny because now anytime she sees Pyle with his mullet, she laughs. But I would go out to Extreme Couture every once in a while, and the problem was there, I wouldn't learn anything, right? I mean, I was just fighting guys. I didn't know anybody, and that's when I got a call from Matt Linlin one time. He was with Dan Henderson, and he was at John Bardis' house, and you know John through Chael. John's a big wig in wrestling and obviously even a bigger deal in business.
I just saw him out in the World Team Trials in Wisconsin. They honored him before the finals, you know, for the World Team Trials.
He's all over the wrestling community. He's helped so many guys out. And they call me from his house saying, hey, how would you like to be a member of Team Quest? Like, well, I'm still active duty, but sure, I'd love to come out and train. And so I did. That was the first time that I go. I think I actually went to Temecula first and trained with Dan there. And I took leave, did that for about 4 days. Then I took leave for about a week, and I went to Portland to train with Team Quest. And here's the most unique part of that. I stayed with Matt Linlin for that week.
Oh God, Brian, that's
I did.
Oh,
at his, but it was when he had that beautiful ranch after he fought Fedor. I mean, this place was incredible. He had workers on his land, and he tells me the first day he's like, "Hey, we're gonna do strength and conditioning in the morning." Oh, great, awesome. I wake up and he hands me a sickle, and I'm beating back briars to create a path for him. Through his briar patch behind the house. That was my strength and conditioning. And I'm sitting here, I was getting, you know, I'm getting mad. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm doing yard work. I've spent all this money and took leave to come out here. So I hit a tree with the sickle and broke it in half and said, sorry, Matt, the thing broke on me.
There's so many Matt Linlin stories that it probably wouldn't even be fair to get into it. But if you were to ask guys, like, the stories about how tough that guy is are legendary.
Oh,
you know, he's just this, I don't know how to describe him. He's just,
he doesn't eat. He doesn't eat, right? I mean, we went, he says, hey, the salmon are in, we got to go fishing tomorrow. We got to go fishing tomorrow. Okay. He's like, but we got to leave here at 3 a.m. And I'm thinking to myself, we have two practices tomorrow. I came here to train, not fish for salmon. I didn't want to say anything. It's his house. All right, here we go. We leave at 3 a.m. to go fishing with some guy named Sandy River Bob. I'm not lying here. We're out on this water by 5 a.m. We're there until 1. We don't eat anything. All Matt does is dip. Yeah. We leave. We stink. We go to the gym for 3:30 practice. I'm eating like nuts trying to find something that I brought in the truck with me. Matt just does one. He drinks a Diet Coke, goes in, and we did like 8 rounds that day and stunk. I mean, we stunk of fish bait. We didn't catch one damn fish. But, I mean, we reeked. So bad. I felt bad. Here, I mean, I didn't know these guys at the gym, and I mean, now I just stink.
I think they were used to Lindland, though.
Common. Yeah, that's common for him. Luckily, Horwich was in the building. When Horwich, nobody smells anything but Horwich.
Is that guy still fighting?
I don't know. At the time, he was living off the land. He literally came in from a bus stop, and Ed Herman goes, "Hey, did you catch anything today?" He's like, "Nah, I didn't catch anything." He's like, "Well, then what do you eat?" He's like, "We're living off the land." He had met some girl, and they were just living outside at the time.
Oh,
okay. I mean, he had ringworm all over his back like freckles, and he trained with his shirt off.
Now, didn't he beat Lytus? Tell us Lytus, like, it's pretty recently?
Not recently. He submitted him a few years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, Lytus is back in against Bisping in a couple months. What were you going to say, Tom?
Nothing. I'm laughing because Lytus is top 10 now.
Yeah.
Matt Horwich is he might have a future if they're taking away these IVs, because that guy would just eat like heads of broccoli and cauliflower and stuff like that back in the weigh-in room. So
I know
he's he could get you down in weight for sure.
I think I think the IV is a big deal because nobody's ever done it the other way before. I would be interested, you know, if I were you guys, I'd have, you know, a George Lockhart, a guy like that on the podcast and get his, because, I mean, he used to argue with me about it. I imagine he still holds that opinion true. And I think guys like him and Dolce are going to tell people that, you know, they actually, I don't know if Dolce likes IVs or not.
Yeah, he's a big IV guy.
Really? Yeah. Lockhart is not. Lockhart hated the fact that I did it.
Now, what from an anti-doping point of view, why is the IV not allowed? Is it because it can flush some possible masking agents out of the system, or?
You know, I've gotten smart on a lot of this stuff. This one came out of left field on me. I am not sure if it is even that complex, or if it's as simple as, hey, we want to make sure guys aren't cutting too much weight. I don't know. I thought first instinct was maybe it has something to do with a way of hiding blood doping and a way of inspecting guys. Hey, we're making sure you're not doing IVs, but we're also inspecting your room to make sure you're not blood doping the day before the fight.
Yeah, that's guys are always going to be looking for that new angle.
Oh, constantly. They're going to they're going to try to get really creative with this. And, you know, there's going to be guys that get away with it for a while. But, I mean, once – When you're talking random testing from trained collectors at labs that don't miss, if you try to do it your entire career, you're going to have a problem. And I just think, too, with the repercussions of these guys who try to go on stuff, then come off it, then go on, then come off it, I think they're going to ruin their bodies and they're really going to have a problem then for the rest of their career that, you know, with what we saw happen to Shlemenko, it's simply not worth it now.
Actually – the USADA head, Travis Tygart, put out he was the CEO of the USADA. When he was on Ariel Helwani's show, he basically said that the reason for the IVs being banned is that, you know, it can screw up or mask or alter the blood testing that gets done. So they've referenced, you know, a lot of cycling, you know, like Tour de France style cycling. Bicyclists would use a bag of saline and that would screw up the test. So I don't think it's necessarily like the dehydration that they're worried about. I think it's, you know, potentially masking other drugs or things like that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, that's a great point to bring up, Tom. I mean, have you ever fought anybody that you suspected to be using EPO?
To be honest, I couldn't even tell you what – I mean, I know what it would do, but I wouldn't be able to tell, you know, any sort of physical markers or characteristics in there. I do think I fought people that use steroids, but.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I know for a fact that I've trained with guys who have cycled on it and have done it. And I have seen firsthand what it's capable of doing. And I mean, you're talking about a guy who 2 weeks ago was barely keeping up for three rounds, is now doing seven and not even getting warmed up till he hits four. And so, you know, if I'm still fighting, I'm happy about that. You know, I'll grab my jug of water and I'll take an extra hour to rehydrate if I know there's a way. I mean, to me, that's the biggest advantage you can get in the sport is the ability to outpace the other guy and wear him down. I mean, look at a guy like Michael Bisping. If Michael Bisping didn't have this incredible heart that simply pumps blood faster than most other guys, and he also has an ability to push himself past the limits. I mean, he beats guys who are much better athletes than him, hit harder, may have better jujitsu, better takedown. He beats them because they just can't keep up with him. They can do a lot of things better than him, but they can't do it at the pace he's going to do it. It's the same reason Clay Guida has beat guys like Anthony Pettis and Rafael Dos Anjos. You could be better than him in every single area of it, but you got to be better than him in all those areas at his pace for 3 5-minute rounds, and it's just hard to do. And that's a cool thing about this sport, where you can have guys that can beat better athletes, guys that are supposed to beat them through hard work, determination, and willpower. That kind of crap takes all that away. It takes away the inspirational performances like you see when Benson Henderson beats a guy like Brandon Thatch. I mean, when Michael Bisping beats a guy like CB Dolloway. I mean, those kinds of performances are performances that leave you wanting to come back for more in the sport. So if that's going to help make sure guys can't blood dope, then I'm for it. And I'm sure I'm not going to be extremely popular in that, because maybe a lot of fighters are like you and they're not aware of the advantages of what blood doping can do.
I mean, this is such a huge game changer. I mean, we're with this random testing. I don't know how you can safely cycle unless you have some kind of stealth. You have your own chemist and you have an unlimited budget to come up with this stuff, like Balco type stuff. Because you do one thing wrong, look at the precedents that have been set recently. 3-year suspensions, 2-year suspensions. That's basically ending your career in this thing.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it's really tough when you're the first ones. You know, and they weren't even in the UFC. That's tough. They weren't even in organizations, you know, where at least guys in the UFC, they've seen this coming, right? Hey, July, we're coming with a new program. It's going to be tough. And that was after a couple of years of already enhanced testing. You know, these guys got hammered in these states. And, you know, I don't feel that bad for them, because I have a hard time believing guys get caught doing stuff like that on their first time trying to do it. You know, we know enough about this sport that, you know what, if you got caught this time, And you knew you were, I mean, especially if you're fighting in Andy Foster state, then you're probably, oh yeah, he was Russian, so there's no way he knows who Andy Foster is. But Andy Foster used to be the commissioner here in Georgia, and then California took him. And I mean, he's hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a step in the right direction. So I think, I don't know if the playing field can ever be even, but I think this is about as close as you're going to get. What do you think, Tom, on that?
I mean, you know, obviously people are always going to find a way to get around certain rules and regulations. And, you know, I'm sure people will figure out a way to dodge some of these tests, but it at least puts a little bit of fear in them. And I think that's the most important thing, is that these suspensions are so heavy and the fines are so much that it will deter people from doing this stuff, really. I think that's the most important aspect of the entire thing, because, you know, people have been able to dodge these tests and you know, there are some kind of loopholes where you could potentially, you know, not show up for the test and you get three strikes basically before you're hit with a penalty. So, you know, I think it's basically just the penalties that are going to be put in place, whether it's 2-year suspension, 3-year suspension. I think those are the things that are really going to deter people and hopefully level the playing field.
Yeah, and the first one, I mean, it's going to hit somebody in the UFC soon. I agree. But, you know, for a guy like you, Tom, I mean, one of your biggest advantages is your strength. You know, we've both trained with a similar coach in you know, Thiago Dominguez, and I didn't train with him nearly as long as you did. But one of the things he would talk to me about you, I've always been a very strong guy. In college football, I could bench and clean more than some of the offensive linemen. And that's been a gift of mine since, you know, I was born. He would say similar things about you. He'd say, man, Tom is so strong. He's so strong. He could finish takedowns he shouldn't be able to sometimes. He could hold guys down. But when you – that's taken away from you when you get to go and take on guys who are trying to get that same thing through a bottle. And it puts you at a massive disadvantage. And not only disadvantage, but the financial impact too.
Yeah, I'm getting that strength through a bottle too, but it's usually a nice like Saison or Hefeweizen.
Now, Brian, I had heard a rumor. You know how I hear these rumors, and they could be completely right, and they could be completely way off. But you were going to be some sort of central figure or executive to oversee anti-doping for the UFC.
I gotta give credit where credit is due. You come up with stuff, and it's so you had said that, and it wasn't true at the time. Was not true at the time.
Right.
Several months later, I get a call about a potential job, and I'm sitting there. The first thing I thought about, because you know I didn't. You said it, and then I had all these people on Twitter coming at me like, "Hey, Stan's going to run the new drug testing program." And I'm like, I am. And I started getting texts from all these different people, you know, other MMA media to try and confirm. And I'm just news to me, guys. No, I've got a job. You know, of course, you know, the opportunity, the potential of an opportunity was presented to me. And while I have been involved, I am nowhere near qualified to be doing something like that. And so I had said no. And the other piece of the pie was, I really love calling fights. Out of all the TV I've been able to do, to include college football, I love calling fights more. You know, this is my favorite sport in the world, and you can't do that anymore. I don't care what anybody would have told me. Like, well, you could still call. You can't call fights if you're going to head an anti-doping program. So that's just. That you know that was out the window, and then what do you do if you build and construct an anti-doping program? Where do you go from there? You know, 5 years from now, what am I going to do for a living? I don't want to be an anti-doping guy. So I think they went out and found the right guy. I mean, they found an expert in the field who's got tons of experience, and you know, I have not met him yet. We've missed each other and have tried to schedule a date to where we could meet. But, you know, they brought in several different fighters to get their opinion before they constructed this program. And so I'm hopeful, that guys are happy about it. I mean, wrestlers will tell you sometimes, you know, tracking where you go and where you're going to be is a pain in the neck with USADA, but I think it's far better than the alternative. It's far better than an environment that really what was happening, and I had to learn this over time because, you know, it's one of the few emotional triggers I have where I will lash out at things, and I'm not proud of that. But I think the environment over time was forcing good fighters, good, clean fighters to eventually say, you know what, I've got to do this for two reasons. One, to compete. Two, to extend my career so I can continue to make money, because that was the environment. The environment was basically forcing fighters to make that choice when they could afford it and go ahead and do that, because that was what we were taught. It's the same kind of environment in terms of how we overtrain and we keep injuring each other. It's just what we were taught, so people don't know how to do it any different. You know, this makes a major change of that, and it stops that young fighter from saying, hey, you know what, if I want to make the top 10, I got to start doing steroids or something like that. They're not going to make that decision now, and now they're going to see the guy that still wants to push the limits, that's a veteran, get a hefty suspension and basically lose their career.
Yeah, Tom, do you have anything on that to add to that?
No, actually, I'd like to go back a second. And, you know, you mentioned, Brian, that you have a job, and you have a few jobs, actually. And you brought up your position with, you know, Fox Sports covering ACC football. And now, are there very many similarities that you find in preparation for, you know, covering these two sports? Because, you know, on the surface, they're not very much alike, but you have a very good background in both. So I'm wondering if there's a lot of prep that goes into each that kind of carries over to the other sport.
There's a lot of prep, and I would you know, I would advise any fighter who says that this is what they want to do. One, there's not many opportunities, but you got to love the prep work. Like anything, you know, any job. You know, Brian, you've got a job. Tom, I know you train people. People always see the cool parts of it. They always see the successes. They see when you get your hand raised in the octagon. They don't see the hours and hours of grueling preparation and detailed work. The guy who's willing to go back for their customer and create all these spreadsheets and analysis and do all the boring stuff to close the deal. And that's what being an analyst is. I mean, same for football. For a week of football, I've got two different teams that I need to watch. I need to watch their last couple of games. I need to know their tendencies. I need to know the ins and the outs of their systems. What kind of offense and defensive system do they run? And then what's the story of that team? And what's the stories of their players? Because ultimately what you're doing as an analyst or a color analyst, you're telling the story. It has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do about them. But you can't talk about them unless you do the legwork. And that's why I love fighting a little bit more than football. Football was a little bit easier because the networks would structure everything. Hey, on Wednesday you're going to talk to the away team's coaches, whatever players you request. They make it easy. Fighting, you just can't do that. It's a wild card. So I end up, you know, calling these guys in the weeks leading up to their fights, going and finding them in the hotels, in the sauna, reaching out to different people to get information, similar to what you do, Brian, to get that so that I can tell the story of these guys and tell the people at home what makes each one of these fighters a little bit different. What about this fight is unique in that, hey, this guy, this isn't plan A for him. This is plan B, and he's still winning. How hard is it to take away, go away from what you wanted to do, have to do something that you thought was going to be disadvantageous to you in this fight, and now you're executing it and you're actually winning? You know, why is he winning? Telling them the story behind that fight. It's a blast. And I don't know. I mean, I like it. You know, I've had a few fighters come up to me and say that they like the way I do that. That means the world to me. Obviously, you're going to get plenty of fans and you call a fight that don't like it. But, you know, I love that part of calling the fight. So there's a lot of prep, and that's where the similarities are, finding the stories, studying the technique, and what's different. You know, when I watch a team that plays in week two or week three of a season, what did they change, you know, now that it's week seven? Man, they were a blitz-heavy team, you know, in the earlier weeks, but then what changed was this kid got injured. They can't go, you know, this was their best cover corner. He got hurt for the season now. They can't blitz as much, and the reason why is because they won't go man-to-man. They won't tell me that because they may not want me to say that and other teams to hear it, but I just discovered it, and I've got to give my reasoning why during the live broadcast because that's what people want to hear at home.
Now, Brian, are you happy the rest of your career? Are you happy being an analyst? Because, you know, I look at you and, you know, the way you represent yourself and the company, and I see something much bigger than just being an analyst, not to downplay it. You know, I see him maybe in a Lorenzo Fertitta type position, you know, if they decide to sell or something like that. Is that something on your radar, or calling the fights, that's your thing and you want to stick to it till you stop working?
Dude, you and your instincts. Yeah, absolutely. I would jump at that job. I would jump at it. I mean, Dana Lorenzo got to retire at some point. You know, that everything's always for sale, right? As much as I love being an analyst, my true love and passion is leadership. I love, you know, I've been fortunate enough to run a company, have a full-time job the whole time I fought, but run this company. And I mean, I've got people that work with me that are just phenomenal. They're great, intelligent people, full of character, a very diverse group. And I've never driven to work and regretted it. You know, there's definitely times I look back and think about my fighting career, man. Would I have been better had I not worked? Yeah, I probably would have, but I don't regret it due to the stability, due to the advancing of my skill sets, you know, as we've grown. And, you know, I've always had my eye on other opportunities to do that. And, you know, Higher Heroes has grown. When we started, we had 3 employees. Now we've got 60. I'm looking to hire about 15 more in the next 2 months. We'll probably be over 100 by next year. And so who knows? You know, I've turned down a couple of jobs in the last year and a half because I want to see this through. But there may be an opportunity, whether it's in the fight, you know, the fight game or just the regular business community. I've had a lot of fun running a company. I'd love to do it again. And who knows, maybe I'll still be able to do both, because right now calling fights is a weekend job.
And a lot of people don't know. I mean, you were a vice president of a major company before you were 30 down in Atlanta. And I don't know where I read this, but it was something like, you know, they hired you, they wanted you there, but they didn't know what to do with you. They didn't know. And you got into, what were you, the vice president of real estate?
Corporate real estate for them. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. So John Bartus, we met once. And he would call me every once in a while. He's so passionate about veterans in the military, because both his father and his grandfather were wounded in World War I and World War II, respectively. And, you know, I had made the decision, which I never thought I was going to make, to get out of the Marine Corps. And, you know, all because of my family. It had nothing to do with fighting. You know, the WEC, I think for my title fight, I made 8-8, which I thought was just, you know, I thought I was rich. But, you know, I wanted to raise my kids. I didn't want to be that father that was gone for the next 20 years. I'm not going to know my kids and you know, lose my marriage one day. So anyways, I was looking at different positions. And I said, honestly, I said, John, my biggest fear, I've had amazing people that I've worked for in the Marine Corps. The only men I've ever had in my life that I've actually looked up to. And, you know, I'm afraid I'm not going to get that. You know, honestly, I know you a little bit, and I wouldn't mind working for you. So he flew me down, and he put me in business development at first with this a whole bunch of Harvard and, you know, Wharton MBA grads, and I mean, very, very bright people. But I mean, they looked at me like I had three heads. Who's this military veteran who also fights in a cage on the weekend, comes into business meetings with fresh stitches? And so the CFO of the company took to me right away. You know, he had been around the block a little bit, and so he had all kinds of ideas, but he needed someone. At the time, he was managing their whole corporate real estate portfolio, and they just did an acquisition of a company that had 7 locations to add to their already 19. And a lot of leases were coming up that were going to be closing that needed to be negotiated. They had all these office projects and logistics, and they want to consolidate in Dallas and Boston where they had multiple offices. He needed someone. You know, he would have preferred someone who had experience in that type of thing, but he needed someone with a master's in just getting shit done. And so he grabbed me for that, and I jumped all over it. And at the same time, that was when I also started running Hire Heroes. Luckily, only had 3 people, so we were really just in the beginning. And I was doing both of those jobs, and after I beat Chris Lieben, I went to John Bartus, who's the CEO of MedAssets, and said to him, John, listen, I love my jobs, but I can't do all of these anymore. I mean, I'm getting any sleep. I'm running out of cages to go take conference calls. I'm going to take a beating in the octagon one of these days, fighting who I'm fighting now, trying to juggle all these balls, not to mention a family. And so that's when I left MedAssets officially and just became full-time employee of Hire Heroes and became executive director of Hire Heroes solely instead of VP at MedAssets.
So I assume the work in Dallas, was that the Broadlane acquisition?
That was the Broadlane and the Acuro acquisition. Okay. And they happened several years apart, but when they acquired Broadlane, I mean, it was just it was a mess in terms of, you know, you had these we weren't even integrated with Acuro yet, and so now you're bringing on this other massive company to integrate them into an already unintegrated group of people that were all in these beautiful buildings, and now I'm sticking them in plug-and-play space in Addison, Texas, instead of Dallas. So they were not happy about it.
So for the people that might not know, like these companies that Brian's talking about, MedAssets and formerly Broadlane, basically they pool purchasing resources of healthcare facilities together to get better pricing. So it's like supply chain management for anything from your local doctor to – you know, a 1,000-bed hospital like Emory or something.
Yeah, but, this is the field that you're in as well, right? You're a salesman in the
Yeah. That's what pays the bills. You know, to be able to go to these UFC. I mean, that's basically kind of how I got a little bit of a name, is just by going to a bunch of these shows. You know,
well, didn't you sell a company too? Didn't you own a ticket company or something like that?
Yeah. That was about 3 or 4 years ago, and then I had to get a grown up job. You know, I'd never worked for anybody else, until I had to get a job when I was 30. You know, from age 19 to 30, I just had my own thing going. And
wow.
Yeah, it was a good ride, but you know, moved on to a grown up job, and you know, I enjoy it. But Tom, what do you got for Brian?
Dude, I don't even know what you guys are talking about.
I was just about to ask, what is real estate Tom going to do when he gets older?
I forgot what I was going to say, but like, Tom, how many jobs do you have? You're training now. You're coaching. You're doing this show with me. What else do you do?
I got the show with Brian Alvarez. That's another thing. I guess that's pretty much it. But it eats up a lot of time because it's just, you know, training is just the most random hours. You know, it's in the morning, it's at night. Sometimes you have to show up during the day if you want to train somebody else. It's just, you know, it really eats up a lot of your time. It doesn't leave you time in a lot of ways to have like a normal life. So doing these podcasts and staying in the gym all day is keeping me busy. And realistically, that's what I need at this point, because living here in Vegas, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you got rehab, you got Wet Republic, you got all these things trying to pull you away from doing the right thing. And luckily, I've been able to kind of, you know, set myself in a bubble with work-related things. So I'm doing okay.
I'll tell you, Brian, you know, you'll have an opinion on this too. But I really think that fighters have the skill set, the experience to be very successful in sales. You know, if you think about it, as a fighter, you've got to be a little bit of a salesman, especially if you make it to a certain level. You're selling your brand all the time. You're being forced to communicate with people in these gyms that you go to train at that you normally wouldn't communicate with. And you're very competitive. And sales is very competitive. And that's typically where a lot of athletes go, and they end up being wildly successful. And so I've often had this idea where if I were running things, you know, I would use a lot of the partners and sponsors of the organization and say, hey, look, as part of this, you got to give my fighters week or two month long internships, which is great for them, right? They're going to get free work. But bring them in to intern and add to their resume a little bit while they're still fighting. Because when guys fight, then they have a couple weeks off. You know, maybe a guy like, let's take Tom, for example, or Joseph Benavidez or whomever. Hey, you want to spend a week over here at this company and you're just going to shadow a person who's in sales or who's in this or who's in that and spend a week with them. You know, however many hours a day you want to do, you set it up. I bet a lot of guys would jump at that opportunity, but I would encourage fighters, you know, a lot of companies in their local communities who know who they are, I bet would jump at a chance to have them come and spend a week with them. You'd gain a lot of experience, and it's more that you can put on your resume for when you do retire and transition out of fighting.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I wish the UFC would put that into some of their sponsorship deals that, you know, hey, Budweiser or Reebok, you know, as part of this deal, you know, X number of our guys have to get some, like an internship, you know, just something for the resume, because Tom and I have talked about this many times. And, you know, it's kind of sad seeing some of these guys who are like good fighters and have made a good amount of money. And then they're 32, 33 years old. They've never had a real job. And then they're like, I'm going to go into coaching. Well, you know what? It's really hard to keep the doors open at a gym. You know, look at Rain. You know, and that's a great gym.
It's brutal. The gym business is an absolute grind. I started one here when I had a family situation that forced me to have to create a camp in Atlanta. And I mean, when I retired, I rode it for a little bit. Okay, maybe I'll see if I can make this thing profitable. But then enough was enough. I was, you know, enough spending money on this thing and losing money. I'm out. And it is a tough, tough industry. And, yeah, a lot of these fighters, they don't spend their money really well. But it's a difficult transition. But, you know, as you were talking about, you know, like the Bud Light internship, I just pictured Bigfoot Silva, you know, showing up to the office one day at a Bud Light center, working with the crew, you know, shaking hands with some of the ladies and some of the guys on staff. And God, I hope they film that if that ever happened.
I was thinking, you know, with the Reebok deal, maybe I could get an internship as like an editor or proofreader for the new uniforms.
I would imagine they have a recent opening there.
Yeah. I saw one of your shirts. They had your first name as the All-American, and your nickname was Brian.
What? Impossible.
Did you see what they did to Jacare? They said, yeah.
See, this is the cool part. When you're retired, you don't get a kit. Like, you don't have to, you don't even look at it. But Thomas, right? Sir Thomas Lawler now?
Yeah, Thomas Lawler. Which, you know, Brian was arguing with me about this earlier because on the phone, you know, obviously my name is Thomas, but it shows up as Thomas on the phone. So he's like, oh, look, it is Thomas Lawler. But here's the thing. Like, you're talking about being able to market yourself. I've never once marketed myself or been referred to on a UFC broadcast as Thomas. So, you know, it's just like, it's kind of insulting to see, you know, a disconnect between the company that's now handling all of these new products. And, you know, there is a lot of excitement about it. And it's, to be honest, it's not necessarily the Reebok deal itself that bothers me, but the way that it was handled at the unveiling was just, I mean, it was kind of embarrassing. A lot of errors, a lot of spelling mistakes, and it's stuff that could have been easily avoided. Yeah. You know, really, that's my biggest gripe.
It's so cool to be in a position where you don't have to watch stuff. No, I agree. Like, for yours, I mean, come on, let's customize it. I mean, there should be a shit stain on the back, right? Like a vomit spot or something, like gets or oil or something on the front.
Yeah.
I mean, let's make this thing real. There's no way you should have sleeves. No way.
No, I would, but they would be yellow armpits.
Yeah, and you should have, you know, a Reebok, like a Ned Reebok hat. I'd have you, like, with the Wave Bear, like, 80 sun. I mean, they could deck you out with some Reebok stuff in your style. And I'm telling you, that, you know, these millennials, they like this hipster stuff.
Yeah.
They'd wear it. I mean, they'd buy and wear the stuff that you put out there.
Millennials? What exactly constitutes a millennial? Because I've been accused of being a hipster in the past.
Really?
And present. So.
You wear skinny jeans?
I just have big legs.
What? Okay. Is that an excuse for wearing skinny jeans?
What is a millennial? Like somebody born after?
It's after a certain point. So it's there's Generation X. I'm 34, going to be 35 in September. I'm Generation X. And then right after us is a millennial. So I think that's, I'm not sure the exact year. I'm sure any of us who's in front of Google can Google it.
I got it here. They say birth years ranging from the early 80s to early 2000s. So you're a millennial, Brian.
I'm not. 1980. I am Generation X. If I'm not, I would imagine, I think I'm born 1980, so I'm pretty sure I'm Generation X. If not, I damn sure act like I'm Generation X. I don't fit in with the millennials as much.
Well, Tom and I are the same age. I was born in 82, Tom in 83. That's interesting. I don't know if I'm a millennial or a...
You guys are right on... I mean, it's right on the line. I mean, I couldn't say... See, it's hard. I mean, millennials are defined by a massive sense of entitlement. They want to be promoted right away. They expect to be promoted quickly. Obviously very, very, savvy in terms of technology, but they lack some of the personal communication tools that are customary in the business world. You know, the ability to establish and maintain personal relationships with employees and have performance review discussions. When you try and give them constructive criticism, they generally tend to feel like they're getting their ass chewed, want to go cry in a corner. I'm being a little hard on them here. I'm teasing a little because there are some great benefits. I've got several millennial employees, and the great thing about them, they can multitask very well. The technology part is great because everything runs on me. I've got several different types of software that we use, and because they like to work on different stuff, the multitasking is through the roof, which is a great thing. And they generally get things done quickly, where the baby boomer generation is used to, hey, let's have 2 hour conversations for 3 weeks before we make a decision, and let's go meet at the bar and have a meeting. Let's go golf 18 holes. I mean, these cats can get some stuff done quick.
Speaking of big decisions, Brian, we haven't even brought up the impending UFC 189 card. And, you know, obviously the big news is that Jose Aldo is out of the fight and being replaced by Chad Mendes. But a little bit earlier on today, there was released, and I don't know if you've seen it, but like a 3D image scan of Aldo's ribs. Yeah, and it looked pretty rough to me.
Look, you know, I pushed out some tweets yesterday. I was cage side when Jose Aldo fought Chad Mendes a second time. I cannot call into question either of those men's toughness. That was probably it is going to be the best fight I've ever called for a very long time. It's going to be hard to beat. That man is tough. When he was doing his post-fight interviews after that fight, he could barely stand up. And so I don't have any precedence to go on to think that he's chickening out or that he was not hurt. Has he been hurt for other cards before? Absolutely. And people have brought that up. He's pulled out of a lot of fights. I'll tell you that there's some luck to that. You know, I think a lot of gyms train the same way, and it's far too hard. And they've got to get a lot. Him personally, he's lost a lot of money on that. So people that are mad at him, don't worry, guys. I mean, you got your revenge. He's losing out on millions of dollars, not thousands, millions of dollars by missing this fight. And I don't think the opportunity will be the same for him. You know, I don't think. You know, that things will work out the way they would have had he taken this fight the first time. And I can't blame him. You know, broken rib, that's like having an open blade inside your body.
Do you think there's any truth to the rumor that, you know, a lot of this stems from the fact that he owns his own very popular shoe company, Aldo, which you can find in very various malls across the country. And he felt slighted because of this Reebok deal.
Tom always has these references that I don't get. I don't know if you got it, Brian.
Because I'm married and I have three daughters, you could guess it. I spend a lot of time in shopping malls, and I have seen the Aldo. It's actually a very high end shoe store too, Tom. I wouldn't suspect Filthy Tom Lawler would know what an Aldo is.
How would you know, Tom?
Hey, you got to eat out of something.
The shoe boxes.
I came across a shoe in garbage disposal.
Hey, and, Tom, did you know he does own his own soccer team?
No. Am I being trolled?
I'm not. You're not being trolled, Brian. You probably knew that. Did you know he owns his own soccer team in Greece?
Jose Aldo.
Jose Aldo owns a soccer team.
I actually didn't know that.
It's like a AAA ball club team in Greece that he owns. Yes.
Greece isn't doing too well right now. So,
you know, that was probably not the best investment. I don't know how many people are buying tickets to soccer games right now. So business is probably not good for them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if you do predictions or you know, you probably want to leave that till fight week, but Mendes and McGregor, I mean, I got to think, you know, Mendes can take him down. You know, we know that, but I don't think he can lay on him and just blanket him for 25 minutes. And Connor's really long, and Mendes has got, you know, these really short arms. How do you see this thing playing out?
Man, you know, and no, I could do all kinds of predictions. I'm not working this weekend, so if Mendes had a full camp in preparation, I would pick him. However. There's a lot of unknowns still about Connor. Even when you watch his old, you know, cage rage fights and things like that, he's very long. He's very big for the weight class. He's better on the ground than people suspect he is. How much better is his takedown defense? You know, because who we saw trying to take him down previously is nothing like Chad. But look, it's not like Connor didn't know that eventually he was going to be tested at this level. So he's had to have worked on it, and he seems to have worked very diligently on every other aspect of mixed martial arts. I don't expect him to do any different with wrestling. And I agree. I don't think Chad's going to be able to lay on him. I think Chad has to look to finish him here. But if Connor starts getting that really long game going, my one question for Connor is, because Chad can take him down so easily, what does that do to Connor's kicking game? Does it limit his arsenal on the feet? Because that's what great wrestling can do for you. Is it makes your striking look better than it really is, because it limits the arsenal of your opponent. And without the kicks, Chad should have an easier time getting inside. You know, so I think that Mendes should be the slight favorite in this fight, and I think he's got more of a chance to win. But it won't surprise me. It will not surprise me if Conor McGregor can pull this off. I just think that Chad is the worst matchup for him in the division style-wise, but he's coming in on short notice, and that's tough.
How about you, Tom?
Man, I don't know. I guess I'm going to say Mendez. You know, that fight he had with Aldo, I would have picked Aldo, I think, over McGregor, even though I did buy McGregor the win previously, but that's no longer the case. I guess I'm going to say Mendez just because it's such a different stylistic matchup. And Mendez wasn't necessarily like getting prepared for somebody with a different style than Conor McGregor. I'm assuming he was in there training, you know, and has enough time, has a couple weeks to pick up the pace and get into really good shape. And I think the stylistic matchup and difference between Aldo and Mendez is going to cause McGregor a lot of problems, you know. And you can look at the interviews that he's done since Aldo pulled out of the fight, and it's kind of like a little bit of frustration, you could tell, I think, in the way that Conor McGregor is carrying himself. And, you know, that could be to his detriment.
God, I bet you'd be. I mean, sitting there preparing for Jose Aldo and you get Chad Mendez? Yeah.
Well, supposedly he was sleeping when they told him, hey, it's Mendez. He gets up at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Did you hear what? That?
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys who trains in the middle of the night.
Yeah, he gets up really late, and out of nowhere he'll be like, hey, we're going to the gym. Like, he invited the guys from Ireland from his gym, but he said, you guys can come and you know, live here for free, but when I say it's time to train, it's time to train.
You know who else trained like that was
Chuck Liddell. I don't know if that was strategy or if that was just Chuck, you know, having a good time the night before.
I think so too, man. Julio Cesar Chavez's kid. I'm forgetting his first name, but Chavez Jr.
Yeah, and he's another guy.
He trained. Yeah, weird like that. Trains like that would just leave Freddie Roach at the gym and say, "I don't want to hit pads at you. I got this fat dude staying at the house with me. He's going to hold pads for me in the middle of the kitchen."
Yeah. His and, name, by the way, it's Julio Cesar Chavez Jr.
There you go. So. I should have remembered that one.
His Jr. part was kind of a dead giveaway, but
yeah. Thank you. That's weird that he does that. So, I mean, I guess John Kavanaugh kind of just hangs out all day waiting for him to say, "Let's go."
Yeah. Yeah, like when all this stuff was going down, I heard he was sleeping, and the coach went into him and told him it's Mendez, and yeah, he was just like, okay. Yeah, huh. Didn't really care.
Who's footing the bill for this house out there and the chef and everything else?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of talk at the UFC, but I mean, I heard he is actually paying for it. You know, he likes to spend money, and you know, I don't think he's made as much money from the UFC as he says he has.
Yeah, you know, I think we have a mutual contact who told us both that. I was surprised. I was surprised at it that you know, not that I believe the money Conor throws around, but I figured he was making good money. And look, the bottom line is, when people want to hate on that, you sell tickets, you're going to get paid more. You know, I mean, it's the reason why Chael Sonnen made so much money. He made that much. He made that much money for them. He was worth it. You know, and so. It's interesting, but well, I'm happy to hear that. If he's paying for all that, I think that saves. I think that's smart on the UFC's part. It would probably be smart of them to leak that information so that people know he does pay that, because it just saves them headaches down the road. You know, when you talk to Joe Silva and Sean Shelby, and you get an idea, some of the conversations they have to get with fighters, and when fighters see things that are being done for other people and not for them, I mean, that causes those two matchmakers massive headaches.
Yeah, you bring up Chael. One last Chael story. I remember 3 or 4 years ago, we're backstage. I guess it was UFC when John Jones fought Rashad Evans. And in about 8 weeks after that, Chael was going to go down to Brazil to fight Anderson Silva. And we're in the back room, and you start going into a strategy about how you get Chael out of this 100,000-seat stadium. And I don't know if this is like top secret national security strategy, but I thought you had a perfect strategy where you work everyone, you lie to everyone, you know, like involved in the show, like you can't tell them the plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was your strategy? Like if you just had to sum it up real quick, how you would get them out?
Certainly. Certainly. There could only be Chael, his wife, and one person that actually know what the real plan is. You've got to have everybody else as a decoy because you can't trust anybody. Everybody has a price. I don't care who they are. There's only very few people in the world who love you enough not to take a gross amount of money and give it to somebody. And down there in a country where there's a lot of people struggling to make decent money, you can get informants real cheap. So you got to have all these people who think you're leaving at a certain time, and then you start to launch people with decoy cars, having them leave in certain cars, and then out of nowhere, when none of them know you're leaving, you leave. He, his wife, his personal security, who are not Brazilian, they're flown in from America with experience, and nobody even knew they were there, they escort him out. And you've got five to six similar-looking vehicles that are all leaving at random times so that people just don't know where he is and where he's going. And, I mean, everybody in the UFC has it briefed. Even Burt Watson thinks that Chael Sonnen's going to leave on the 3 p.m. flight. He's leaving at the midnight flight. And that's – you got to have a lot of decoy documentation out there because you have to automatically assume that everybody but you has a price willing to sell your information to somebody to know where you are. And you know stories. I mean, it's not a safe place. Rio de Janeiro is one of the top 10 most dangerous places in the world. Imagine the cities out there and how hard it is to make the top 10 list.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Mogadishu, you've got Yemen, you've got, I don't know, every city in Syria and Iraq right now.
See, the thing that scared the shit out of him was something happened to Steve Frazier, the Greco coach.
Yep.
Down there, and I don't know, he ended up like on the street or something, and he had no idea what happened.
He was gone for days and for several weeks wasn't right. He was basically at a bar and someone came from behind him, injected him with something, and then that was it. They took everything he had and he didn't come to. He was gone for days. They couldn't find him in Brazil.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and the worst, that okay, got it. That is an easy to defeat scenario for a guy if they're going into a situation like Chael would have been in that situation. That one's easier to beat. The most dangerous course of action for the enemy in that is someone who's just there to crash your car and spray the whole car with bullets. That's the most dangerous thing because you just – how do you stop it? It's like a suicide vehicle in combat. No matter how you stop the thing, it's still going to do a certain level of damage because of the massive explosives in it. How do you stop a guy who's willing to hit you with this vehicle, spray the whole car, and then attempt to get away? I mean, it's the most overt thing you can do, but it also has a high success rate. And so that's why I told Chael, if you're going to do this, this is what I recommend. And I told him, I said, look, have your security call me. I'll talk to them about it. Because I didn't trust, you know, most other people on these things are lazy. But anyways, he got in and out for the Ultimate Fighter just fine. So I tend to maybe go to extremes in terms of security. It helped me in a previous life.
No, but this, just to be clear, this was about the fight that was supposed to happen in Brazil that got changed to Vegas. When he went to São Paulo for the Ultimate Fighter, you know, he had his image down there. It wasn't he wasn't public enemy number one.
No, but they liked him a lot more.
It was still kind of dangerous. Brittany never left the house. It was still not great.
Yeah, no. Back then, when he was supposed to fight Anderson, I mean, they hated him. I had guys, you know, I trained in Atlanta. The guys that I would train with are primarily Brazilian, and I mean, they couldn't stand him. And it was so funny because when I went to International Fight Week 2 years ago, two of these guys were out there, Doug Lima from Bellator and Rafael Sunsal from the UFC.
Sure.
And I brought them backstage with me before I did one of the shows, and Chael came walking in. And they meet him, and no character, just Chael. And he left, and it was so funny because I was sitting there laughing. I go, admit it, admit it. And they both go, damn it. God, and it was so hard to come out of their mouth, and they knew if they went back to Atlanta and said it to everybody else, they may get a beating. But at that time, I mean, that's how hard it was if you were Brazilian to not hate him.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom has something coming up. Tom, you're going to Hawaii for some kind of armed forces. You're going to watch some fights with the troops. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. I've done a variety of tours. And the last one I did was over to Turkey, Greece, and Italy, where upon landing in Turkey, there was like a protest because of ISIS beheadings. Very close to the airport. So we landed and we immediately got like tear gassed at the airport. So that was kind of an interesting situation for me.
Only happens to you.
Yeah. So, I'm going to Hawaii with Pro MVP Sports, which is a company that takes various UFC fighters from the past and present. And I'm going over there. I believe Mark Munoz is another fighter who's going to be there. And we put on a seminar for the troops on base, and then we'll be watching UFC 189 with them. So I've been blessed to, you know, go basically all across the world and visit military bases. And, you know, it's one of my favorite things to do, to be honest. People just, you know, Brian, I mean, I'm sure you know it, and I'm like so far down the totem pole when it comes to stuff like this and living in danger. I'm a white kid from the suburbs. And that's pretty much how I've lived my whole life. So seeing the sacrifices that people in the military make, it's just, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me in a lot of ways. So
They love that stuff, though, man. That's so cool that you're doing that. They, you know, there's a lot of people, especially when you're in country, that'll go do base visits. Now, obviously, they only go to the air bases where they're completely safe. Like, they never come, and none of the the forward deployed guys, the combat arms guys, are ever going to see anybody, but they don't care anyways. Like, you could have a singer that shows up and maybe someone will show up to see him. They don't care. You send a fighter out there who's going to maybe do some rounds and teach a seminar, everybody shows up. They love that stuff. Love it. Love someone who's willing to get on the mats with them and show them different techniques. I mean, it's such a cool escape for the day. Even when you're a guy who lives in Hawaii, I mean, most people would think, oh, wait, you're in the Army or the Marine Corps and you live in Hawaii. Oh, lucky you. Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, they still have to deploy. They're still every 3 years being told that they're moving somewhere else if they're lucky to stay there for 3 years. So that's a really cool thing you're doing. And I'll tell you, that's stuff that they'll remember. And the people you communicate with will be Tom Lawler fans for life.
Yeah. I don't know if they're going to spend $95 on a Reebok jersey, but.
Hey. No. They're not going to rock $95. You know, the only thing is, right, if you're going to charge that much money for them, make it look more like a jersey, right? People are going to spend that on their NFL team because they're going to wear it every Sunday. You know, yeah. They're going to wear that, and they'll spend a good amount of money on that. I think based on the criticisms they've received, I got to imagine these things within a year will look a little bit different. It didn't surprise me that much. I mean, I was kind of just like, eh, when I saw them. But when you bring up that specific point, what's going to drive someone to go and buy that one? I don't see, especially for the middle tier guys, you know, I don't see their fans being really like nobody was going to go buy the Brian Stan jersey for $95. That wasn't going to happen. Now, if you're a Chael Sonnen, you're a Conor McGregor, you're an Anderson, you're those guys, people are buying your jersey.
But I think the issue is the prominence of the UFC logo on the front. It kind of throws people off, and I know why they're doing that. I mean, the brand is bigger than any individual. I can totally see their point with that. But I think a lot of people don't want to wear a shirt that says UFC across the front. If it said Conor McGregor or Brian Stann or Chael Sonnen, you know, then they'd be like, okay, I'm representing this fighter who I want to support. Not necessarily this huge company that, you know, maybe they don't even like. There's a lot of people that don't like the UFC's practices.
Yeah, I agree. People buy a jersey if they believe in the team, and then they want that player. Right. This isn't a team sport; it's an individual sport. They want to buy the jersey for the fighter. I agree with that, and I get their point too. You know, I mean, they're gonna throw this out there, and they're gonna see how it looks. I wasn't, you know, when I started to think about it more and I looked at them, I wasn't too surprised that that's how Reebok designed them, just because wow, this I can't say. Well, all the cooler designs are taken by Nike and Under Armour, right? I mean,
yeah.
I tend to buy a lot of their stuff. And so, you know, they have to be unique. They've got to find a way. You know, for a guy like Cowboy Cerrone, how his wouldn't be camouflage, I don't know why it wouldn't be, right? I mean, he's got a very big brand in the UFC. So I think they need to go back, rethink some of these. And some guys have some real obvious ones to where, hey, we can make this a lot cooler. You know, like Conor McGregor's, his whole thing, you know, instead of the weird, you know, just the flag on the sleeve, the shirt should look like the Irish flag with his name on it.
What right? about you the tattoo he has on his chest? You could throw that gorilla with the crown on his head. On
yeah, side. Yeah, why not? If you're going to wear the jersey, you want to look like him, right? You can even put some abs on there and then put the tiger on the belly button.
Oh, God.
I like that idea. I like that. You know, you could do an Ariane Celeste jersey for women, and they could, you know, it's like the tuxedo T-shirt.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point. That Ariane jersey would probably sell better than her album.
I never heard her album. Proud to say, never listened to that.
Yeah.
Oh.
It wasn't too popular.
Yeah. Well. I sure can't sing either, so.
Yeah. Well, neither could she. But, I wanted you brought up the team jerseys. You seem to have something going with the Atlanta Falcons. Are you, what is your role? Are you training those?
Yeah. This was pretty wild. So I had gone out to Los Angeles several times and, you know, Jay Glazer, in association with a bunch of prominent strength coaches, you know, he had developed – actually, no, with Chuck Liddell and Randy Couture over years, he developed this training program for NFL athletes using mixed martial arts techniques, help them get in better shape, help them have more of an aggressive mindset, help them do some things that are different that their muscles aren't used to. He's been doing it for years, and you know, they've been pretty successful at getting at a group of anywhere from – 10 to 20 guys every summer that come out. It was pretty cool to see. You know, you go out there for a show, you go work out with them for morning, and you're working out with a bunch of NFL guys you used to watch it on Sundays. So it was cool to get to know them and work out with them. Anyways, he pitched the whole concept to the Atlanta Falcons 2 years ago when Mike Smith was their coach. And I went up and met with him for a day, and they just didn't want to fit it into the budget and the agenda. This year, Dan Quinn, the new head coach, was all about it. I mean, he loves fighting, loves toughness, was all about that competition. And so he brought me and Raymond Jordan, former University of Missouri All-American wrestler. We came in with Glazers there on the first day. We stayed for the next 3 weeks and basically trained them in different wrestling, fighting, kickboxing techniques, you know, that were, you know, geared towards different football, you know, instead of you know, pushing guys off the line, how to punch better. And you know, if you can, football players are 4 or 5 seconds. If you can go hard on these heavy bags for 30 on, 30 off segments and be able to listen and focus on technique and make adjustments on combinations I'm calling, you know, you're easily going to be able to do a 5 second play. And so we went in there, we had a blast. And, you know, Dan Quinn, the head coach, actually would come down every single time and be there with us as we're, you know, motivating the guys. And, you know, we made it pretty cool. And after each session, you know, I would pull, you know, some kind of story or some kind of vignette to talk to them about it, to really explain why we were doing it. You know, there's no reason for Julio Jones to learn how to be a kickboxer. But Julio Jones happened to want to learn righty and lefty how to kickbox, and he actually became pretty good in just 3 weeks, go figure. It was more about the mental side of it. And I read to them this vignette about how the Spartans, they did a lot of their field training, their really strenuous exercise. It had very little to do with their legs and more to do with their minds, because the true test of a warrior isn't to win the battles that they should win, right? It's to win battles when your legs are gone and the only thing you have to depend on is your will. And so Dan Quinn really wanted to take this team that he viewed as not being known for their toughness and make them a team that's tougher. And I think I'm going to head back there, you know, when they start their camp in August as well, and really just kind of maintain a relationship. You know, I did a couple different speeches for them and stuff, and they really like the fighter's mindset. The guys will draw a line in the sand and say, look, win, lose, or draw, I'm not backing up. You're going to have to make me. And they want that instilled into their football players. And cool opportunity, and I like talking about it because, again, it's just it's one other avenue and thing that fighters can go use even now as they go look for different sponsors and have to get really creative. This is value they can bring. These are things that can are, that can be transferable even in a regular employment sector for a sales force, where you have a group of people that have to work together towards a combined goal and they need to be motivated. Fighters are good to do that.
Yeah. Tom, maybe you can call up Bill Belichick.
Yeah, actually, I have an in. I already have an in with a couple other – with another team. And actually, I attended a Falcons game, when was it, 2 years ago? And they got crushed by the Saints. And I must say, I was not too happy with the – they have like these ambassadors in downtown Atlanta. And my current girlfriend and I asked, you know, we were like, hey, what's up with the – where's the stadium at? You know, can you direct us in the way of the stadium? And basically she – I can't remember exactly what she said, but – she used some profanity because, you know, my girl was in a Saints jersey and basically just told us to go F off. So
that's the ATL for you.
Yeah, she was on a Segway trying to help people, you know, in the city and then telling us to get out. So
that's our good Southern virtues. Yeah, it's rare. I've loved living in Atlanta. I think I love it more so just because of the prices here and your money can go so much further. But, yeah, if anything, it's tough to be an Atlanta sports team. They're not a big pro sports city. I mean, they finally got on board with the Hawks because they were winning this year. But it's not one of those cities that's like a Chicago or a New York that's always behind their team. I mean, like you guys in the Northeast. I mean, everybody's crazy for the Patriots up there. Yeah, I got to call fights with John Anik. He won't stop talking about the Patriots.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's it comes down to them in BC as the two big powerhouses up there.
I love BC's head coach. I love it. That's, you know, you had come to one of their games that I was calling and yep. Steve Adazio is awesome. He was recruiting for Tita's kid.
Yep. We're buddies with somebody who's a coach there and he's a big fan of yours.
Their strength coach. Their strength coach loves you. The minute I showed up in their facility, he was talking about you and I told him, yeah, you know, well, you know, we haven't really met, but we both shared, you know, I borrowed a coach off him for a little while and this guy, Tiago Dominguez, but they're super, super guys. That's a program of just character, man. Adazio is one of those guys that if you're a father and you want a real man, a real leader leading your son on the football team where he's gonna learn some character, that's a kid you send him to play for.
He's looking for real dudes on that team.
That's his big word, right? Always be a dude. Yeah. With a big dip in his mouth, spitting all over you. I love it.
Well, all right. Hey, Brian, you've been really generous with your time. I got one last question for you. This is actually because I consulted with Chael, like some of the stuff I should ask you. And he wanted to know your take on Donald Trump, because he's all in on Donald Trump. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. No, I don't think it's going anywhere. And he also wanted to know when you're running for public office.
I can't run for public office until I have Chael to manage my campaign.
Yeah, well, you'd get banned. He's been banned from everything he's ever been involved with. I know.
I think that's coming. I think that'll come back around. I honestly think that Chael will end up coming back around at some point, especially now. You know, now what happened to him in hindsight after so many other people, I think people come around. But in terms of Trump is far too much of an egomaniac, and gosh, does he say some really, really dumb stuff. So here's the deal, right? I mean, to cheer for Trump is going to be a waste of a vote. America is never going to vote him in. If some chance by a miracle he wins the primary, he does not stand a chance against Hillary Clinton. So I think he's a distraction. I think that he's making everybody else who's trying to run the Republican Party look bad. So if you're someone who typically votes for the Democrats, you're probably ecstatic that Donald Trump entered the race and started running his mouth. So, I mean, I know Chael's a big conservative. If he wants a conservative president to get elected, he better hope to God Trump gets out of this race quick.
Who do you think gets it? Scott Walker?
Man, you know, I think it's too early to tell. I really do think it's too early to tell with that field. I mean, the thing that makes me so mad, this is the best we have to offer. Are you kidding me? Yeah. This is it? We have these amazing, amazing CEOs, these amazing former generals that are retired. I mean, people that I've met that will blow your hair back with their intellect, their wisdom, their humility, and their experience, and they won't run because of our system and how degrading it is to everybody, because they're going to dig on you and they're just they make the process awful. And so what we're left with are these B-team people. I mean, Hillary Clinton is most – I mean, the odds say she's probably going to be our next president. The fact that she could help to engineer a sale of uranium to a Russian territory while her husband was there getting paid $700,000 for a speech, and then they gave them $30 million to their foundation while she was Secretary of State. The fact that that can happen and she doesn't go behind bars absolutely baffles me. And I vote the person, not the party. I've given up. I hate them both equally. I'm ready for a third party in this country. But that crushes me, because the common man who gets a DUI will go to jail tomorrow when he had a – and that's a big mistake. No doubt about it, a huge lapse in judgment. But it's very frustrating. When you are a leader, you're supposed to be held to even higher standards, and just not the case in Washington. And I think a lot of people are fed up. But the problem is they're fed up, but they don't take action in it. And we have got to do a better job of forget watching the news. Make your own decisions. I follow – my Twitter is basically my newspaper. And I follow a lot of on-the-ground journalists. And if they associate with a party, then my rule is if I follow them and they are typically a liberal, then I have to also follow someone who's on the ground in that territory from the opposite party. So then at least I can read both sides and make my own decision, which, you know, most of them are supposed to be unbiased. So you gave me a really simple question and you wanted a short answer. And like usual, I ran my mouth for too long.
Are you an Alex Jones guy?
I haven't gotten on that train yet. I haven't done enough research on Alex Jones yet. I honestly do not know who I'm going to vote for at this point. There's a lot of noise out there. Someone that I respect an awful lot did tell me they're supporting Jeb Bush. And I asked him, I said, do you really feel that they'll be a good president? And they thought that he would be a great president. Now, I did not think that prior to that, and not because of any real research I've done. So I was surprised to hear that. So I will look into him more. The other gentleman, who's the other gentleman running behind Hillary? Son of a gun.
O'Malley?
No, the other guy. Bernstein?
Brian, I don't think there's been a guy behind Hillary for a while.
Is Cuomo's kid?
Mariano? Yeah. No, the older gentleman who's making some waves and gaining some ground. Bernstein.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernstein. What the hell is wrong with me? Bernie Sanders. So he's another gentleman that I've got to look into more when we get close to the data of voting for the primaries, to look at either side. I personally really want someone who's going to go in there and do a much better job with foreign policy, because that's in my opinion the weakest area of this administration.
Well, Brian, how do we – this ISIS thing, I mean, I've kind of gotten out of all the politics. I've been really disillusioned and about the two-party system. So that's – I've kind of – I used to be a mainline Republican, and as I've gotten a little bit older, I've just kind of more of like a libertarian, like, hey, why don't we just take care of business here at home? I forget where was I going with that? I was going to ask
ISIS.
You.
How do we beat ISIS?
Oh, yeah, ISIS. I mean, I just see the things that they're doing on my timeline on Twitter, and I'm just like, what can be done? I mean, who was it? John Kerry who called them the JV team, or something?
It was Obama.
The JV team. I mean, well, they're a pretty ruthless JV team.
Oh, absolutely ruthless. And you got to imagine when in terms of terrorism like that, you've got a lot of really seasoned mercenaries that are going to go where they're going to make the most money. You've got people that have been in this game fighting against the Soviets, fighting against the British, fighting against the Americans for a long time. These are seasoned jihadists that are good warriors that know what they're doing, not good in terms of the morality side of it. And they're going to go join ISIS because they're going to make some money doing so. And so they're not a JV team. And we got to remember, too, you could call them a JV team if we were going to go back to old school war like we did in World War II. We're going to carpet bomb cities and we're going to send waves of American forces over. Yeah, we'll make them look like a JV team. We'll crush them. But you just can't do that in today's media age. You'd never get away with it because of the collateral damage. I mean, World War II, we carpet bombed entire cities. People don't talk about it because there wasn't the media that exists now. In order to defeat ISIS, first of all, first and foremost, I'm furious over this, but what is the plan? What is the objective? I never even received one when I was in Iraq. What is our country's objective in terms of ISIS? Are we trying to annihilate them? Are we trying to contain them? Are we trying to hinder, slow them down? Give me a mission statement, and at least then I could hear you try to justify it. There is none of that. If we truly want to annihilate them, then we have to come to terms that we are going to have a long-term presence in the Middle East. And I would argue that in 2011, when we failed to negotiate the agreement to stay on helping to train Iraqis, that was the beginning of turmoil in Iraq when we left. And I'm not getting into the argument of whether we should have gone in the first place or not. I would tell you right now we shouldn't have. But when Syria collapsed, that was the creation of ISIS. It wasn't Iraq. But when Syria collapsed, that happened. If we want to annihilate them, we're going to have a long-term military base located in western Iraq, which is right on the border of Syria. I was stationed there in Al-Qaim, and very similar when you saw World War I, World War II, when these things ended, what came out of them? One of the biggest army bases we have in the world is in Germany, not in America. It's in Ramstein. We have multiple bases in Japan, in Okinawa. If you want to have long-term influence over an area, that's what it takes. Now, on the flip side of that, does America want to be called empirical again? Do they want to be talked about as an empire? And then for people that would argue that, okay, do you want ISIS? Do you want a sustained and long-term jihadist and terrorist threat like we've seen? You know, it's going to take someone from the West to have and basically plant a very large presence in the Middle East to influence long-term. It's the only way you get long-term influence over an enemy is you have to be there forever. You can't go in, do a regime change, and then leave. We've tried to do this three times in Afghanistan, three different times, and we just don't read history, and we just keep going. The Soviets try to do it. The British try to do it. We're trying to do it. It's never worked. Never worked, because once you leave, it goes back to what happened before, and it just becomes chaos. So you cannot go and do that in these parts of the world, and I'm not an advocate for either. I'm an advocate for leadership that goes in there, they do their historical research, they decide what America can tolerate, what we can live with, and what we want to do. They give a mission statement so that not only the existing military knows what they're being sent for and what their mission is, but for the men and women who are walking to recruiters tomorrow that are going to decide whether they are going to enlist, at least so they have an idea how they're going to be utilized and not guessing as to whether they're going to be deployed in a combat zone for somebody else's mission and possibly die. So I think we should expect and demand more of our leadership than that. And if you want really great insight into the Middle East, there's a guy named General Mattis. He's done some interviews. He's brilliant. One of the most well-read men in terms of history that you'll ever meet. I would Google him, and he will give you insights that just other people can't.
And that's Mattis?
That's it. That's it. He'll blow your hair back with some of his insights.
James Mattis, retired U.S. Marine general. Wait, did you serve under him while you were?
He commanded such a large force that, you know, technically, you know, I think I was under him for a very brief part of time, but he was active while I was in. And not just in the Marine Corps, but nationally. He was so respected. I mean, this man will speak and he'll quote different books, pages, authors from, you know, all throughout history, because he's the kind of guy, I've met these kinds of guys before that are officers in the military. They have this deep respect for history and the lessons you can learn, because obviously, look, Smart people learn from their own mistakes, but wise people learn from other people's mistakes. And he's a very wise person. You know, he will scour it. He will not go into a country and not know everything about its history. You know, what is a Sunni? What is a Shia? These are things that were foreign to us when we went in after 9/11. Nobody knew about any of that jazz. We had no idea what we were doing. I was working with interpreters while I'm dealing with Sunnis, and my interpreter's a Shia. And what do you think this Shia is telling me that this Sunni is saying? You think he's giving me the truth? No. He wants me to throw this guy in jail. Wants me to do something. You know, and we didn't know any of that. We don't know that stuff at the time. That's a shame.
Well, all right. Hey, Brian, really appreciate it, man. We, you know, talk some fighting, talk some more serious stuff. That was a good conversation. Tom,
my pleasure, guys.
You got anything in closing?
No, just, you know, Mike Pyle said he never hit on your wife. Said he didn't
lying. Remember. Doesn't remember.
He said he doesn't remember. So
that's so cool that you went and confirmed. I'll tease him. He'll take that in stride too.
I had to check my sources.
I love it. That's good of you guys. Awesome, guys. I had a blast. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. Take care, buddy.
Thank you. All
right. You got it, guys.